Hi, everyone, and welcome to Womanist Bible Talk, a podcast for womanish Bible readers and friends, where we engage stories about women in Scripture from the perspectives of contemporary women of color from different walks of life and various socioeconomic backgrounds. I'm Vanessa Lovelace, an Old Testament scholar, and I am joined today by New Testament scholar and guest co-host, the Reverend Dr. Mitzi Smith. Mitzi is the first African-American female to earn a PhD in New Testament from Harvard University. She is the J. Davison Phillips Professor of New Testament at Columbia Theological Seminary in Decatur, Georgia. She is a preacher and the author, co-author, and editor of 10 books, including Chloe and Her People, A Womanist Critical Dialogue with 1 Corinthians, I Found God in Me, A Womanist Biblical Hermeneutics Reader, Womanist Sass and Talkback, Social Injustice, Intersectionality, and Insights from African-American Biblical Interpretation. Mitzi is also the host of Beyond the Womanist Classroom podcast, where she discusses all things womanism, biblical interpretation, religion, and justice. Welcome, Mitzi.
Thank you, Vanessa. I'm glad to be here and look forward to this conversation.
If you are joining us for the first time, the Womanist Bible Talk podcast is intended to broaden our listeners' knowledge of stories of women in Scripture beyond what's usually heard from pulpits. The guests interviewed redeem the reputations of women such as Jezebel, Delilah, and Mary Magdalene, who are often represented as bad girls of the Bible, and introduce other women who have either been nameless or hidden behind the men in the biblical stories. Thank you for joining us. We are excited to have Margaret Amer as our guest today. Some of you may remember Dr. Amer from episode 3, where we pay tribute to Dr. Gay Byron. Dr. Amer is Vice President for Academic Affairs and Dean of Faculty, the first woman and the first person of color to hold that position, and the first Presbyterian Church Shreveport D. Thomason Professor of New Testament Studies at Austin Presbyterian Theological Seminary in Austin, Texas. She is an ordained minister of Word and Sacrament in the Presbyterian Church USA. She earned a BA from Harvard University and the MDiv and PhD from Union Theological Seminary in New York. She was awarded the Doctor of Divinity degree from Cole College in 2006 and the Doctor of Humane Letters from Hood Theological Seminary in 2013. Dr. Amer has published 4 books, James, Diaspora Rhetorics of a Friend of God, Fortress Commentary on the Bible, New Testament, First Pure, Then Peaceable, Frederick Douglass Reads James, and Islanders, Islands, and the Bible, Ruminations. A native of the Caribbean, Dr. Amer's research considers migration, post-coloniality, and Islander readings, and Black feminist womanist thought in relation to the New Testament. Margaret is here to discuss her article in Womanist Interpretations of the Bible, Outrageous, Audacious, Courageous, Willful, Reading the Enslaved Girl of Acts 12.
Margaret, could you share with the listeners why you chose to write about the enslaved girl of Acts 12?
Well, of course, Mitzi, it's nice to be here and to be with you women again. My decision to talk about the enslaved girl of Acts 12 came because I was writing a sermon about her when Gay and Vanessa invited me to be a part of this volume. And so I had already done some research and some thinking about her, and I thought this would work really well as an article, not just as a sermon. As you know, those of us who preach and do Bible often do Bible research when we're getting ready to preach. So it was doing double duty.
That's true. That's true. So tell us about the title and how you and why or why you describe this young girl in this way.
Sure. Outrageous, audacious, courageous, and willful is one of my favorite lines from Alice Walker's Choria poem that introduces the idea of womanism and womanish. But it also describes what it would be to be an enslaved girl child who refuses not to speak her truth, who refuses to be silenced because she knows she's right, even at the possible cost of her bodily safety. That would be outrageous, audacious, courageous, and willful behavior on the part of an enslaved girl. And so I thought that would be an appropriate title and an appropriate part of the womanist ethic to invoke when talking about this child.
Mm-hmm. Indeed. So you open with the phrase, quote, to read darkness, unquote, and later, quote, darkness readers, unquote. What do you mean by reading darkness? Who are darkness readers in general? And who are they in your essay, especially as it pertains to Rhoda?
So reading darkness is a quotation that draws from Vincent Wimbush's work in African Americans and the Bible. And he was my doctor father at Union. So, you know, the apple doesn't always fall that far from the tree. Darkness here is trauma, enigma, the unspoken and hidden lives of those marginalized by the central storyline. It's the counter narrative to the heroic story, the bringing to voice of those long silenced. In the case of Rhoda, I wanted to humanize the darkness, the trauma, and the silencing surrounded this enslaved and possibly trafficked girl serving at the door of a Christian household in Jerusalem. Darkness readers are those for whom this sort of reading matters, those for whom trauma and marginalization are part and parcel of their lives to a greater or lesser extent, and who need to see and hear their stories and who choose to see and hear their stories reflected in the pages of these texts.
Margaret, Rhoda's story is set within the wider narrative about the Apostle Paul's miraculous deliverance from prison in Acts 12. For our listeners who are not familiar with Rhoda's story, could you please read Acts 12 through 17a, and help us get into the story?
Sure. So this is a story that takes place just after Saul of Tarsus has been converted to the Christian movement, but before Saul becomes Paul, and before Paul starts his mission. And it actually happens in Jerusalem, and the central character isn't Paul, it's Peter. Peter is arrested by Herod Agrippa, and he's thrown into prison. And then there is a miraculous story about an angel appearing and an earthquake, and Peter realizing that he has been miraculously released. So that's where we get to in Acts chapter 12, and reading from the New Revised Standard Version, updated edition, the writer of Acts says, as soon as he realized that he was free, Peter went to the house of Mary, the mother of John, whose other name was Mark, where many had gathered and were praying. When he knocked at the outer gate, that's when Peter knocked at the outer gate, a maid named Rhoda came to answer. On recognizing Peter's voice, she was so overjoyed that instead of opening the gate, she ran in and announced that Peter was standing at the gate. They said to her, "You are out of your mind." But she insisted that it was so. They said, "It is his angel." Meanwhile, Peter continued knocking, and when they opened the gate, they saw him and were amazed. He motioned to them with his hand to be silent and described to them how the Lord had brought him out of the prison. And then he added, "Tell this to James and the brothers and sisters," and then he left and went to another place. So this is a story of Peter's deliverance. The maid in the story, the one that they call the maid, is actually an enslaved girl whose name is Rhoda. She's called a paidiske in Greek, and paidiske in our texts always means a minor female who is enslaved, so an enslaved girl.
Haitian enslavement was not as bad as U.S. antebellum slavery. You argue that for readers, particularly for abolitionist darkness readers such as Frederick Douglass, the presence of stories and laws in the Bible that support slavery and slave holders is a problem. Please tell us about enslavement in the New Testament and how readers like Douglass try to reconcile the horrors of slavery and the need for the Bible as a defense against slavery.
Yeah, that's a big question. So I think even for lay readers, the best source for information about slavery during the New Testament is the work of Dr. Jennifer Glancy. She makes things very plain, very accessible. And what Dr. Glancy points out is that enslaved people were ubiquitous throughout the early church and throughout the Roman Empire. And they were the bodies, they were seen as the bodies of those who enslaved them. So what you couldn't do to the free person, you could do to the enslaved person. Glancy points out that enslaved people had, as we say today, no bodily autonomy. They had no way to protect their bodies from anything. And that means hunger and cold, but it also means physical brutality. It means sexual brutality, just as we see today. In field gangs, and Rome had field gangs, enslaved people were chained and whipped, and all the sorts of things we see in the Deep South took place also in Rome. There was branding, there were metal collars connected to the necks of enslaved people. People were marked on the forehead if they tried to run away. So there were all sorts of violences that took place. And of course, both enslaved girls and boys could be victims of sexualized violence. The main difference between human enslavement in the antebellum South in the United States of America and human enslavement in Rome is that human enslavement in Rome was not racialized. So it was not primarily based on one's color. And that was the main distinction between human chattel slavery in Rome and human chattel slavery in the United States of America. Having said that, Douglass needed the Bible, and many of the antebellum and abolitionist folks needed the Bible to be able to defend the faith against what Douglass called the woman-whipping, slave-holding religion of the Deep South. And Douglass was very critical of the religion of the Deep South. So Douglass, like many interpreters before and since, chose the parts of the Bible that didn't uphold slavery, that condemned kidnapping, that called for love of neighbor, that called for treating one another as you want to be treated, and upheld those as more important than the parts of the Bible that upheld slavery. The thing is, the Bible is a library, and both Douglass and many other people even today treat the Bible as if it is a book. And so they want the Bible to be consistent in saying the same thing over and over as if one author wrote it all the way through. But this is not, as you and I both know, a book, it's a library. And so different parts of the Bible can be used in different ways and have been used in different ways based on the theology of the user.
Thank you, Margaret. You raise questions about Rhoda's ethnicity and migration, which leads to the question if Rhoda is even really her name. I'd like to tie this to Vanderbilt University doctoral student Naf Zakaria's dissertation on Dina in Genesis 34 and the reception history in antebellum America, where Dinah becomes the generic name for enslaved Black women. I won't reveal too much about her dissertation before it is defended, but could you talk about how her name has a bearing on her ethnicity, migration, and status as a slave?
Well, let's start with the fact that Rhoda is, like Dina or Dinah, a common slave name. Many, many enslaved girls were called Rhoda. So the fact that she is called Rhoda by and of itself marks her as a slave. In addition, her name may mark where she was purchased or where her people were purchased, because it could be a derivation of Rhodos, Rhodes. And the island of Rhodes was a known slave trading port. So it also could be that she is named for where she was purchased. We see that that practice in other parts of the ancient world. Marcus Terentius Varro, this is from my article, relates that when three men buy one slave at Ephesus, one of them will call him Artemis, while another will call him Ion, after Ionia, the district where he bought him, a third Ephesius, because he was born at Ephesus. So it would not be a stretch to say, oh, she was named Rhode, because she was purchased at Rhodes. That's the feminine derivative of Rhodos. What this means is that we don't really know what her real name was, what her mother would have named her. We don't really know if she was born in the house. She could have been a house-born slave. That was very common in Roman period. Or whether she was purchased and trafficked. At some point, someone in her family was likely purchased and trafficked, if not she, somewhere else. And that also means we don't know whether or not she's a Jew. Chances are very likely that she's a Gentile that has been purchased and trafficked and bought by this Jewish family that now believes that Jesus is the Christ and is being used as an enslaved person in this household.
Wow, you really took us deep there.
Very interesting. Margaret, you write that womanist biblical hermeneutics must read darkness intersectionally. Would you please explain the implications for interpreting Rhoda's story in Acts by reading from page 283 of your article, beginning at the third paragraph through its ending on page 284?
Sure, I'm happy to read that. I start with the fact that what Luke wants us to do is to follow his argument about Peter, right? He wants us to pay attention to Peter and Peter being released from prison. And what I claim is that womanist methodology does not allow us to follow Luke too closely. We must attend to intersectionality. That is, we must attend to all of the different other things. Race, gender, ethnicity, immigration status, age, enslaved status that make up who Rhoda is. We are compelled to read the darkness of Rhoda's world. To do so is to read Rhoda on her own terms. She cannot simply be a literary bridge in the story of Peter. She has her own story. To the extent that we can know it, we must tell it. Telling Rhoda's story restores her personhood, if not her name and birthright. She ceases to be a tool, an object to perform a task. Her story becomes an intersection between enslavement and freedom. She stands at the crossroads of ideal and real communities of faith. Her role as truth teller holds us to account. If we accept Peter's emancipatory testimony, what are the implications for Rhoda? Can we follow a liberating God while enslaving a trafficked Gentile girl? Can we do both, right? And so what I'm trying to help us to see is Rhoda's whole personhood matters. She's not just a simple character. What I'm trying to get us to understand is that Rhoda is a whole person. Luke just intends her as a character to get to Peter's story, but in putting her in the story, he has introduced us to a person that, for some of us, is an ancestor. For some of us, is the story of the women who came before us, who themselves were enslaved girls. And we cannot, as darkness readers, as people who read for the trauma of the world, who pay attention to those in trauma, who pay attention to those on the underside of society, we can't read Peter's story without stopping and asking the question about Rhoda, about if Peter is free and if Peter is letting folks know that Christ is a liberator, what are the implications of that for this enslaved girl whose body is absolutely on the line here? Because the context of all of this is Herod is looking to arrest the Christians. He has already arrested Christian leaders in Jerusalem. There's a knock on the door at night, and the person they send to answer the door is the most vulnerable member of the entire household. the person most likely to have bodily harm because they're enslaved, the person who is young and vulnerable and has no say in what happens to her body because she is property. And this is what the Christians do. So what is our response as Christians to Rhoda's story? Because we cannot preach Peter's liberation if we're not also looking at Rhoda's liberation.
Yes, yes, indeed.
And Luke erases her from the story. After Peter declares that he's free, we never hear from Rhoda again. So it's not enough to allow her just to be a literary bridge.
Yeah, our listening audience can't see Mitzi and I nodding our heads as much.
This is true. This is true.
But we were right there with her.
Yes, yes. That's a powerful point because we want to celebrate one and forget about the other.
Right.
And Luke encourages us to do that.
Yes.
It's not just that we want to. The narrator encourages us not to ask the question, what happened to Rhoda?
Exactly. Yeah. Yes, yes, yes. That's true.
But there is a theme of truth-telling enslaved girls throughout the scriptures and truth-telling enslaved women throughout the scriptures.
Yes.
And Rhoda is part of a group of women who have ordinarily no power, no right, no vote, no even personhood, who are the bearers of truth. And we ignore them at our peril.
Margaret, what surprised you as you wrote this essay?
I think I was a little surprised at how passionate I became about Rhoda. You know, I hate to say fun, because I mean, it's not fun to write about slavery, but it was an exhilarating piece to write. It allowed me to think through how to tell the story well and how to bring in voices from not only the American African diaspora, but across the African diaspora. Each of the sections is a quotation of a different woman of African descent. Some of them are African American women, and some of them are Afro-Caribbean women, you know, and trying to make that bridge and make that connection beyond the United States context, which is part of the reason I said yes to this. As somebody who was born outside of the United States context, whose people are from outside of the United States context, I just did a 23andMe. I have no genetic link to the Western Hemisphere, none. All of my genetic links link back to either Africa, or 30% of them link back to Asia, to India, which is not uncommon in the Caribbean. Kamala Harris is not the only one with that story. one of my frustrations of early womanist biblical interpretation, and that has changed over time, and I understand why it was. It's been so U.S. focused that it hasn't taken into consideration the broader conversation of Black feminism around the globe. And so I wanted to bring in some voices that were not just American voices, because even enslaved people at the underside of the society participate in a society that is an empire, right? And this is Chanel Smith's whole point in looking at Woman Babylon, which I think is a brilliant piece of work. And I wish she had written more about that because it's a really wonderful, helpful book, her piece on ambivalence, that we are always already both oppressed and oppressor. And yes, we stand yes. in those interstices and have to live into that reality, right? So wanting to uphold those who, as I sometimes tell my French husband, are not the ones who colonize the world.
So last question, Margaret. What do you most want listeners to take away from your interpretation of Acts 12?
I would most like listeners to pay attention when you're reading scripture or even when you're reading just literature, those characters that come and go when we don't know anything else about them. Pay attention to the enslaved girl who tells Naaman there's a prophet in Samaria and wonder about her. Imagine her life. Ask why it is that the narrator tells us she's there, tells us she knows something, and then completely obliterates her from the story, you know, wonder about the enslaved girls who call Peter out for lying in the courtyard of Caiaphas. Wonder about their lives. Wonder about why they get to tell the truth and why we never hear from them again. You know, wonder about the enslaved girl of Philippi, who truthfully says these men are enslaved to the Most High God. And Paul shuts her up, takes away her truth-telling power. Wonder about her and what her life is like. I think we need to be careful not to close our eyes to the presence of slavery in the text. And we need to ask the question about the lives of the enslaved, because their lives are often silenced. So what is it that they are bringing? What is it that they are saying? How are they being used? How might we reimagine the endings of their stories? Will Gaffney does a beautiful job in the story of Hagar, imagining her death. And she has this wonderful ending to the story of Hagar that she's written about Hagar going back to Egypt and being mummified and buried and all of her generations. It's absolutely brilliant. Where are those stories for all of the rest of these girls? Can we imagine the next part of Rhoda's story is, and when they turned away from Peter, they looked at Rhoda and said, the God who set Peter free also sets you free. I mean, is there a space for us to imagine the next right step? Even if the people in the narrative didn't take it, what should be the next right step? Where should we go next? So that's what I want people to do. I want people to pay attention to the voices we don't pay attention to.
Yes, yes. Thank you so much, Margaret, Dr. Amer. And thank you
You're so welcome.
Oh, yes, our pleasure. And thank you so much for joining us. This was a wonderful conversation.
Absolutely. Thank you, Margaret. And that brings us to the end of this episode. Thanks for listening to Womanist Bible Talk, a podcast for womanish Bible readers and friends. If you enjoyed this podcast, please spread the word on your social media platforms or by word of mouth to others who might be interested in this topic. Check out Womanist Interpretations of the Bible, Expanding the Discourse, at SBL Press or on Amazon.com to keep the conversation going. Music for Womanist Bible Talk is composed and performed by Denman Turner Entertainment Group. The cover artwork for this podcast is Woman with Her Own Garden by Merlan Jean-Gilles. Support for this podcast was provided by a Louisville Institute Sabbatical Research Grant. Peace.